Alpha, it's not apogee, it's the Alpha Centauri, no, Alpha Helium. When Halley's Comet is at the maximum distance from the Sun, Halley's Comet is a relatively small object that is as dark as a piece of coal. And when it's not near the Sun and putting out a great big tail that you can see, the object itself is this black piece of coal way out there beyond Pluto, and they measured the light output reflected from the Sun by Halley's Comet, and it was at, I think, the 29th magnitude. A human eye can barely see a star at the 6th magnitude. Bigger numbers of a given star has a logarithmic relationship. So the 29th magnitude, this group at the European Southern Observatory with their best optical telescope measured it, and they were getting something like one photon per second, receiving that with an optical telescope that had, I think it was, an 8-meter diameter mirror. Can you imagine? That's what? 30-foot diameter mirror, if I understand correctly, if I remember correctly. And in that great big mirror, they were getting something like one photon per second, and they integrated that picture for some length of time and measured the light output of Halley's Comet. To my knowledge, it is the deepest measurement ever been made, way beyond anything we've done with Hubble. If that Hubble ultra deep field measurement, where it saw 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before, in that 1 million second integrated picture that Hubble did, well, about 8 or so years ago, if that was done with a
repeater, time out.
If that Hubble deep field picture had been done with the same techniques, the same resolution, the same sensitivity of this European Southern Observatory measurement of Halley's Comet, I don't know the exact number, but I'll bet you they would have seen 5,000 more galaxies out there. You ain't seen nothing yet. Just wait till the great big infrared telescope. Why can't I keep thinking of the name of the dark thing?
YDY?
YDY? Webb. And the James Webb Telescope, when that's launched in 2016, that's going to be the biggest thing we've ever put into space. Mr. YDY, go right ahead with your question, sir. KQLIW.
Dick, what was Manfred's last name?
XQ2FOD. X-ray Quebec 2, Foxtrot Oscar Delta. We'll tell you everything you want to know about him. His last name, my memory of the last name was Manfred Bornhedwig. Bornhedwig, which I think is a German name. Go ahead.
Thanks very much. I'm just going to look him up.
Yeah, you can also find him in the December issue, 1999, QST Magazine, the first main article on that very exotic 12-volt switching mode power supply. And the second half of the article was January 2000, QST Magazine. So there's four different ways you can find him. Interesting character. He and I were sending emails back and forth to each other for a couple of years. He and I have very different theories as to what a radio wave looks like inside of a coax cable. Oh boy, we must have spent 10,000 words back and forth to each other arguing about what does a wave look like when you're measuring it with a standing wave ratio, piece of instrumentation, a network analyzer, a slotted line, time domain, reflectometer. When you're looking at a wave inside of a coax table, particularly when there's a wave going forward and a wave going back, he and I argued that till the cows came home. And after 2 years of arguing, we came to the conclusion we're going to agree to disagree. And I found out 2 years later, 3 years later, he slowly is coming around to my method of analysis and understanding. I may have almost won that argument, but I'm not sure. But he's the guy that was maintaining all of their electronics, a very smart guy. And I gave him some of my physics puzzles. I told him, be careful how you use these. That I'm guessing that the people in Chile, most of them were European origin. Let me drop it. I was guessing that the European schools had equally as many holes in their education as our American schools. So I told him, be careful with these physics puzzles I'm giving you, that when you give them to your European people, because to get up to the mountaintop at the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, Chile, it is so hard to get there. You drive for 5 hours to get on these mountain roads to get there. So these guys would dwell there for a week and a half, live there on top of the mountain, then they're off for a week and a half, and then we'd come back for another week and a half. So they were living together. So at the breakfast table, he gave some of these guys some of their physics puzzles. And he didn't do it quite diplomatically enough. Because the puzzles seemed so simple, but there's really a zinger to them, and these guys got mad at him for bringing to their attention holes in their knowledge, they ended up taking their car keys and throwing them at him at the breakfast table. He described that scene to me. I told him, you weren't careful enough with your diplomacy, with the way you were asking those physics puzzles. You got to be careful. I think I told you guys that any of the people who have ever worked with me have been subjected to my physics puzzles. And two-thirds, three-quarters of the engineers really get enthralled by them. They'll meet me each day and say, hey, Dick, what's the puzzle of the day? But there's a certain percentage of engineers who will see me coming down the hall and they go in some other direction. They don't want to see me face-to-face for fear I'm going to ask them another one of those puzzles. They can't tolerate the fact that there's a chink in their armor, that there's something they don't know. There's a certain kind of engineer who thinks, just like there's a certain kind of physician, who thinks he knows everything. He's the authority, and you don't challenge him. That's a person who hasn't yet been humbled by life. Mother Nature is eventually going to humble you. That's the philosophy. Anybody want to say anything about all of the above? Give me a call that is right now. Or if you got a real question for Paul, give us a call that is right now. KQIW and TechNet.
Another question.
Jiggly with a question also, Dick.
Okay, Wes and John in that order. Go ahead, Wes. And Wes, try to give us one question at a time, Wes. I know that you're interested in some darn many things. You sometimes give us a question with three or four subjects wrapped together. And sometimes you lose us with the complication. Try to make it one question there, Wes. N2XJN, KQLIW.
The one subject question. Is about 1 photon per second. Are the photon bicycle particles is in frequency an attribute that would generally associate with the waves rather than particles? It's a mass-like particles, of course. So what is that we are actually measuring when we talk about frequency of the photon? And also I would like to know what you say about quantum momentum of the particle.
Remember now, my philosophy is that a radio wave or an optical wave, any kind of an electromagnetic wave, launched anywhere, goes everywhere. The only thing left to discuss is it's getting weaker and weaker by the inverse square law. Eventually, you get down to the point where the amount of energy per square centimeter, per square meter, whatever units you want to use, the amount of energy per unit area that you're receiving from that source gets into extremely small numbers. We can talk about the energy in electron volts that are equal to one particular photon at this particular wavelength, this particular frequency. And so, is it really a bundle of energy that we call a photon? And when you try to make the wave duality, particle wave duality understanding of what Mother Nature is doing with very weak, very small signals, can you analyze it as a wave of a particular amplitude? Or a particle of a particular mass. Which one is correct is not clear. Depending on how you run the experiment, you can come to either conclusion. But no matter how weak that signal is, in the case of what the European Southern Observatory did when they measured the light output of Halley's Comet at its aphelion, let me drop. They knew how much light they were getting. They knew how much area they were using. On the biggest mirror they had, aimed in that particular direction for hours on end, and they were collecting an amount of light that when you calculate it in the particle theory, where you call it a photon, and you know how much energy there is in a photon, they called it, was it 1.5 or was it 0.75, or something in the vicinity of one photon per second, from the particle understanding of the energy they were getting. One photon per second. Could they have measured one photon per hour? I think the answer is yes, but there's a catch. They had to go through a very elaborate procedure to get rid of the flare light. As dark as the Altacoma plane, or no, it was actually La Salina. They were not at the Altacoma plane, where the major telescope is near La Salina, Chile. But in the 10,000 foot high mountain, which is in a very, very dry area where they get very clear sky, as clear as that sky is, there was background radiation of the sky that had to be subtracted out of the picture in order to resolve Halley's reflection. So it was a difficult procedure, but they could do it over and over again, so to speak. They knew that they were getting the real thing. There were various ways they could confirm. So is the light they're getting a particle or is it a wave? The answer is yes to both. It's a matter of how you look at it. It's a real tough area. By the double slit experiment, you could think that all light is individual particles. By another way you do the double slit experiment, you are positive that each photon is a wave of energy that goes through both slots. And after it goes through the slots, by interferometry techniques, you eventually accumulate a photograph on your screen after the double slit experiment, which has interferometry pattern. It's got stripes to it. It's got areas where there's brightness and areas where there's darkness. That looks like a wave. And yet, you could do the experiment in such a way that you're launching one photon per interval of time. You can make the light source as weak as one photon per second, and you'll still, after the double slit experiment, get that interferometry pattern. It's a tough one. And people will be arguing for the rest of you and my lifetime, Wes, is it a particle or is it a wave? I think the answer is yes. Depends on your philosophy, your point of view, your method of measurement, your instrumentation. But I do know there is no lower limit of energy. That's what I see. All the evidence I see, no matter how much you double the distance, no matter how much you weaken the source, no matter how much you put in an attenuator between you and the detector, you can make the signal weaker and weaker and weaker. It doesn't disappear. It never disappears. It'll go by the threshold. It'll go below the threshold of your instrumentation. But by all the measurements you can do, it's still there. There is no lower limit. The pure philosophy of particles of photons would lead you to believe that if I go below one photon, there's nothing to measure. Well, you can measure an amount of signal that looks like half a photon. Does Mother Nature issue half photons? I doubt it. I think she's issuing waves. You're hearing a bunch of philosophy. I ain't sure on this one. Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, and I'm going to pick up John right after you. N2XJN, KQRIW.
Yes, I just said we come back in the science section because I have a problem with your answer. Because then I should ask about the fusion of the radiation due to the inverse square law. And I could also say that we are measuring photon energy that is related to the frequency of the wave, which would be E equal HF, where H is the Planck constant. And light was previously considered to be the wave. Since it bends around the corners and gives interference patterns, etc. So, you know, the people measure the black body radiation or the black plants discover that things work better if the energy comes in the packet. And that's what I'm leading to. I recall that Einstein has used his energy in packets idea to explain the photoelectric effect. But now things is being explained a different way, and they consider to obey the laws of the quantum mechanics, and because of that, it has the frequency and so on. So what I was trying to really relate when I was responding to that is relationship between the temperature of the body and the emission of electromagnetic radiation. That would give us a equal pattern for the discussion and to
hear. If I go back to what Paul gave us earlier, the Big Bang, roughly 13.7 billion years ago, here we are, a universe spreading out as far as it possibly can, as fast as it possibly can. The signal is getting weaker and weaker, and yet, with modern-day instrumentation, starting off with the Penzias-Wilson experiment of 1967, done at Homedale Bell Laboratories, and they won a Nobel Prize for it. They measured the background radiation, 2.73 degrees Kelvin. They made that measurement. The amount of light left over of the afterglow of the Big Bang the universe in all directions at once, they measured 2.73 degrees. If the answer was not 2.73 degrees because of the number of years and the bigness of the Big Bang, if the answer was now 1.14 degrees Kelvin, they would have measured that also. Is there a limit to how low the signal of the background radiation of the sky can be and you can't measure it? I think there is no limit. You use modern-day radiometry techniques, signal subtraction techniques, and you can measure a weaker and weaker signal. There is no limit that I can see. You will find a limit today. Let me drop.
AC2IS query.
Bill recognized, and you're going to be after John. You will find a limit today with today's instrumentation. Tomorrow, with better instrumentation, you will measure below that limit. What's the weakest signal you can measure? What's the longest distance you can make a ham radio experiment, a ham radio communication? What's the longest distance you can talk to your spacecraft? I see no limit. What's the maximum number of antennas you can scatter in space and still suck up that signal? The answer of the number of antennas is close to infinity, because the total area of space is close to infinity. And I can put an antenna in every one of those square centimeters or every one of those square meters of every one of those cubic meters of space. The signal goes everywhere, forever, and never stops. It gets weaker and weaker. Use the right instrumentation, you will measure it. That's the history. Very similar to the history of ham radio itself. When Clinton DeSoto, I'm guessing roughly 1920, wrote his book, 200 Meters Down. Let me drop. The broadcast frequencies up to 200 meters were considered good for AM broadcast. And beyond that was those higher frequencies that are useless. They were given to the ham radio operators. Those useless frequencies lower than 200 meters, higher in frequency than 1.5 megacycles. And the ham started finding ionospheric reflection or refraction at very long range communication. And all of a sudden, these useless frequencies became very valuable. That ham radio scenario, higher and higher frequencies, more and more value of the spectrum, we keep repeating that every one or two decades. There's another kind of law. Well, I can't think of the name of the law now. We double the number of transistors every year.
That's law, Dick.
Give me that name again.
Moore.
Yeah, Moore's law. There's a Moore's law where you double the number of transistors per chip every year and a half, and you double the number of lines of code in your most advanced piece of electronics every 2 years. Everything is doubling over and over again for decades after decades. The ham radio operators, they go 10 times higher in frequency every 1.5 decades and find brand new frequencies that have use. Those higher frequencies, all above 30 megacycles, all above 300 megacycles, all above 33 gigahertz, all above 30 gigahertz. The FCC officially assigned those upper frequencies, all above blank, on multiple occasions, saying, you own it, do whatever you want, you don't even have to obey the laws up there. You don't even have to identify all the time, if you know what I mean. You're in the wide open spaces, you're in the untamed territory. That scene has happened over and over again. There is no limit with modern-day instrumentation. What's the highest frequency? What's the weakest signal? What's the longest range? There is no limit. Tremendous amounts of past history keep saying that over and over again. There are various people who say, you will never go beyond X. Well, somebody keeps doing it. KC2WGB. Let you figure this all out, John. K2RIW, the TechNet.
No, I have quite a mundane question for Paul. I'd like to know if you've ever read about or seen anything about moon pigeons, like the bird. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Paul. I'm not sure what that means, but you got it.
Moon pigeons? Is that what you're saying, John? Is this what people see in the moon when they look at the moon? What are we talking about? I know they've seen the rabbit. The Chinese have looked at the rabbit and things like that. Different types of things. But what's a moon pigeon?
Okay, yes, moon pigeons seen on the moon or during the tours around the moon overpasses by astronauts. And I'd just like to know if you had read anything about that. But that's okay. It's pretty rare. But I thought you might enjoy that. If you have a way of looking that up, you may be interested. And you can let us know next week, maybe.
Three.
ring a bell. That all came out with the different things that people saw as they went around the moon. And Chinese, of course, saw the rabbit 4,000 years ago, but when Apollo 8 orbited the moon, they might have seen was, you know, something in the landscape that looked like that. That there was some kind of bird. Rings a bell, but I'd have to look into it further, John. I had one question for Dick, though, dealing with the Alma Array. They located these things in Chile. You would think, well, high up, 3 miles high or something, but to whatever it is, their altitude, not 3 miles, but I think close to it. I could see that for optical. What's with the radio telescopes? Is there something about the sub-millimeter band that they didn't say what frequency? And I can see if it's up in the X-band category. You know, you might have problems with the atmosphere. Is that what the problem was, Dick? Why did they go so high? Are they going to do it, for instance, in the Death Valley area, like Sirocco, Mexico? We have another array there. Thank you, Dick.
The Alma Array on the Alta Coma Plain, which according to 60 Minutes tonight, they called it 16,500 feet high. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's very close to that. That is 3 miles. 3 miles above sea level is where they are located. And that's a millimeter, sub-millimeter away array, way beyond X-band. Sub-millimeter, X-band is only 10 gigs. Sub-millimeter begins at 300 gigahertz in sub-millimeter. You're between a rock and a hard place when you're building a radio telescope. The higher the frequency, the given area of your radio telescope gives you a certain beam width, very predictable beam width. And you could round it off by saying the magic number is 70 degrees. Every time you increase the number of wavelengths, a width of your aperture, the number of wavelengths of width of your aperture divided into 70 degrees tells you the approximate beam width you're going to get. Okay, when you build a sub-millimeter array that's a fraction of a mile in diameter, we're talking about arc seconds or sub-arc seconds of beam width out of that array. When they combine the signals from all of those individual dishes. Let me drop. So that thing is giving them extremely high resolution of a radio telescope signal that they're measuring. And the nice thing about those sub-millimeter waves, you could call it very long wavelength infrared if you like. I mean, there's an overlap in that region. So it's a very long wavelength infrared radio telescope. And the atmosphere is extremely slightly attenuating at that frequency. The infrared frequencies, the atmosphere, particularly if you've got any moisture in the atmosphere, really start sucking up that signal pretty fast. So you want to be on the highest place you can get, on the driest place you can get. The nice thing about the Alta Coma Plain is it is east of a set of mountains in Chile, where the mountains are to the west of them, and so the air coming from the Pacific that tries to go over the mountains goes up to a very high altitude, gets dried out real fast, and so the air that manages to get over those mountains and get into the Alta Coma Plain is by far the driest piece of place anyone knows of on planet Earth. Let me drop it. The Alta Coma Plain gets an amount of rain of approximately a tenth of an inch of rain per decade. Is that place dry? Any place on planet Earth. I don't care if you go a mile down below the ice in the Antarctic. I don't care if you go to the deepest place you can find in the Pacific Ocean. No matter where you go on planet Earth, you take a sample of that water or that soil, and you culture it, you will find living organisms. Any place on Earth, some kind of extremist life will find a way to live there. I don't care if it's an acid bath in a geyser that's in near... I can't think of the name of the park in California.
Yellowstone.
That's it, Yellowstone. So you can find an acid bath in Yellowstone Park, and you'll find things living there. All right, so you take a chunk of that soil out of the Alta Coma Plain, which is so darn dry, and you culture it by any means you want, and you don't find any life. That's the one place in place on Earth that can't find any life. That thing is the driest, highest, coldest desert you and I can imagine. As such, Manfred said, I ain't going to go there anymore. And he quit the company to make sure they wouldn't send him there. Because if you're not there and consuming, I forget the exact number, but maybe it was 6 liters of water per X number of hours. If you're not consuming water that fast, your body dries out so fast that it becomes life-threatening. The air is so thin, if you're not breathing oxygen, you're going to get sick. He went there a few times, and he got mountain sickness. And he couldn't drink water fast enough because of the thirst, the way his lips were drying out, whatever. That's a really rough place to live for any length of time. And yet you got a bunch of scientists there who set up all of their equipment at the base of the mountain, and when they got it just right, they whipped it up to the top of the mountain because they want to do as little service as they can out in the open air. The laboratory that...
Repeater, time out.
The laboratory they get up there, which has got the world's, one of the world's biggest supercomputers to take all of the data from all of those dishes and combine it into a phase-corrected picture. That laboratory has oxygen pumped into it so that the scientists doing the work on that computer would not be going into oxygen starvation, hypoxia, and start becoming irrational in the way they would act. So you're pumping oxygen into the laboratory where the computer is. The computer doesn't need it, but the people there do. So that's a really tough place. But the whole reason they're using that is because those sub-millimeter wave frequencies do experience atmospheric absorption. If you find the right curve, and one of the places where you can find the curve I'm talking about is you go to Dr. Tom Williams' website for microwave, the really serious microwave enthusiast, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org. You go to that website, and you go to the curves that were issued by, I can't think of the guy's call letters now, at W4. He's got a series of curves of what is the atmospheric absorption for various sub-millimeter wave frequencies. You'll find that there's a whole bunch of absorption bands where the atmosphere is not completely transparent. So as you go up to these super high frequencies, super short wavelengths, that atmosphere ain't as clear as you would like it to be. There's something crazy about the atmosphere that when you go even higher to the optical frequencies, 550 nanometers, which where you and my eyes work, all of a sudden the sky on a non-cloudy day becomes clear again. So there's a bunch of complicated reasons as to why there's all these individual oxygen suckouts and water vapor suckouts and whatever in the atmosphere, frequency versus attenuation. So that array, if it was the best of all worlds, that array would be in space. But the best they can do is the highest, driest place they can find on planet Earth. And that's why, with great difficulty, they located it there. I wonder if that's sort of the answer you're looking for, Bill, before I go over.
Repeater, time out.
Is that sort of the answer you're looking for, Paul, before I go over to Bill? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. They're transmitting to a general audience, so they just said sub-millimeter and then the large millimeter. Without saying what the frequencies were, although they were talking about color, although I knew that was the law, but I it looks like they're in the infrared area. Very good, Dick. I had no idea what they were talking about, 300 gig. Now I do. Are you going to take a guess at what the large millimeter band was, what frequency that is, Dick, before you go?
Yeah, if you and I go to the ESO website, European Southern Observatory, guarantee you'll get a lot more. And just Google the word ESO or ALMA, A-L-M-A. We'll get a lot more data. Submillimeter is below 300 gigs. Higher frequencies than 300 gigs is submillimeter. The higher millimeter waves are lower in frequency. 94 gigs is probably one of the frequencies they're going to be using. The serious ham radio operators have chosen places where when you plot atmospheric attenuation versus frequency, you see a dip in the curve where the atmosphere doesn't absorb as much. You get a beautiful dip at around 120 gigs. You get another beautiful dip at around 243 gigs. So the really serious microwave ham radio operators, have done most of their work at those two frequencies, 121 and 243 gigahertz. 243, by the way, I vaguely remember what harmonic that was of 144 megahertz. All the microwave ham radio operators use a harmonic of 144 megs to set their frequency because they literally take a 2 meter transmitter and listen to the umpteenth harmonic as a frequency reference. And so I think it's the 2,000th or the 1,000th harmonic of 144 megs, the 243 gigahertz. And you'll notice that the 121.5, 243, is it 21.5? Anyhow, when you go through the mathematics, you'll find it's an exact multiple of 144. It's not a coincidence. When you look at that graph that I published in the article on the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish, August 1972, QST, you'll see a graph where I plotted frequencies versus gain you'll get out of a dish for various wavelengths. The repeater.
Time out.
Boy, am I getting forgetful. You'll see a graph where the vertical axis is gain you get out of the dish, horizontal axis is diameter of the dish, and the various sloping 45-degree lines represent each individual diameter of dish, what gain you can get out of it, what beam with what gain. And then the curve doesn't go up at a 45-degree angle forever. It all of a sudden curves back down because of your surface accuracy. So you'll notice that those frequencies, when I published that curve way back in 1972, were 1296, 2304, 3356, 5600, 10.368, and so on. Where did those numbers come from? They were the harmonics of 144 that I was guessing the ham radio operators were going to be using in the future. And boy, that was one of the few places where I guessed right. I guessed the guys would get onto those frequencies by using a harmonic of the 144 transmitter, and therefore, even though the 10 gig ham band is operable from 10.0 to 10.5 gigs, why the hell would they choose that crazy number, 10.368? It's the 72nd harmonic of 144. So you can see how some of this jazz comes about. And by the same token, you choose a notch in the atmospheric absorption curves for various amounts of moisture in the atmosphere. Let me drop.
Question?
And that's how you end up with those frequencies. All right, the next guy who signed in before Wes asked his next question was Bill. AC2IS, go ahead with your question, Bill. K2LIW in the tech net.
I recall you saying something earlier today about microwave frequency having a higher resistance loss in cables. Why would higher frequency have a greater loss?
Okay, I'm hearing Bill through earphones, and Bill, you were 80% noise, 20% audio, but I got everything you said. Bill's asking, why should microwave cables, why should a coaxial cable at microwave frequencies have higher and higher loss as you go up in frequency? And there's two answers for that, skin effect and loss tangent. In the case of the copper, so to speak, of the center conductor and the outer conductor, the phenomena called skin effect means that as you go to a higher frequency, the RF energy is exciting those molecules on the surface. I mean, that signal going down the inside of your hardline piece of cable, really it is reflecting off those walls. Not very different than the signal that you send with your flashlight into a mirror at a 45-degree angle. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. The signal reflects off your mirror. Your signal is reflecting off the walls of that microwave cable. And it shakes the molecules on the surface. They do a certain amount of absorption and re-radiation. But that signal propagates a little bit into the copper. They call it the skin effect. And where the amount of signal strength into the copper goes into a fall off of 1 over E. E is the natural log, 2.718. When the signal falls off to roughly 37%, we call that the skin depth. That's a logarithmic function. So as you go to higher frequencies, you look up the word skin depth and you'll find out there's this formula, 1 over the square root of a bunch of terms. Let me drop. Where you plug in the conductivity of your material, whether it be copper, aluminum, steel, whatever, you plug in the conductivity number, you plug in some constants, and you plug in the frequency, take the square root, divide it into 1, and that is a skin depth. At 432 megacycles, for instance, your piece of coax cable, the skin depth is in the vicinity of 1/10 of a 1/1000th of an inch. 1/10000th of an inch is how far the RF energy goes into your cable at 432, into the copper conductor. Go to a higher frequency, it goes to a smaller depth. The smaller depth means that you're lighting up less copper and you get more resistance. So the rule of thumb, the slope of these curves that you see of coax cable loss versus frequency, and it's usually plotted logarithmically horizontally as frequency, vertically in decibels, again logarithmically in decibels, and when you do it correctly, it's approximately a 45-degree line throughout most of the frequency region. And the first question is going to be, why does the line slope up with more loss at higher frequencies? Most of it's because of skin depth. As you look at those coax cable charts of loss versus frequency, let me drop. You notice the end of the curve close to the point where you shouldn't go beyond that frequency with the cable, because the cable starts acting as a piece of waveguide. It doesn't even pay any attention to the center conductor anymore. That's the next higher mode, the TE11 circular mode of a round piece of waveguide. Your coax is going to do that at some frequency. Before you get there, you notice the curve takes an extra slope upward. That's where the loss tension of the dielectric material comes about. Teflon, for instance, is an extremely low loss material at microwave frequencies. Water, by comparison, is one of the lossiest materials you can find. Water absorbs RF energy like no tomorrow. That's what makes your microwave oven work. That microwave bouncing around in your oven finds the water in your food and boils the water, and that's what does most of the cooking. A little bit of it is the fat absorption. Most of it is water. You put completely dry bread in your microwave oven with a glass of water. The glass of water will boil, and the dry bread will sit there, and nothing happens. It runs ice cold. So, loss tension is what we're talking about here. Now, the mechanism within a dielectric material that affects the loss, oh boy, we can get into a beautiful discussion at the molecular level what's happening there. It's a lot more complicated than you think. However, take my word for it. Every material that is a dielectric, an insulating material, let me drop. Every material that you use as a dielectric, that's a fancy way of saying I'm putting it between the two plates of a capacitor. And if the dielectric constant is 3, that means that when I put it between the plates of my capacitor instead of air, my capacitor now has 3 times as many microfarads of capacitance. That's what dielectric of 3 means. However, as you go up in frequency, every dielectric material, with rare exception, has more loss at higher frequency, dielectric loss. That's a very complicated mechanism. Take my word for it. More loss to the dielectric loss at the high end of the frequency. Most of the loss at the frequencies you and I use are copper loss because of skin depth. I wonder if that sort of answers the question, Bill. ACQIS, and anything you do to raise the altitude of your antenna would be helpful, Bill. ACQIS, K2RIW, the tech net.
Okay, I'm standing on my toes now. Maybe that helps. The microwave energy or a higher frequency energy does not penetrate as far into a conductor, and therefore less of the conductor is available to conduct that energy. I'm not sure I understand it, but I think that's a good summary of what you said, AC2IS on the side.
With you standing on your tiptoes, your signal did get 3 dB stronger, Bill. And now you're 60% noise and 40% audio instead of 80% noise and 20% audio. You sound better. If I take a piece of 14-gauge household copper wire and I measure ohms per 1,000 feet, which is the way the curve is usually done, I forget the exact number, maybe it's 2.4 ohms per 1,000 feet, because you're making the measurement at DC. And at DC, every bit of the cross-section of that copper is conducting some of that signal for you, some of that signal by which your ohm meter is measuring ohms. It's putting a certain amount of current through the copper wire, measuring how many millivolts of drop, and then your ohm meter, you could say, goes through a calculation, and it says 2.4 ohms. As you go up in frequency from DC, at 60 cycles, for instance, the really big pieces of cable start developing skin effect. You look at the 60-cycle performance of 00, triple O conductors that are used for, you know, 1,000 ampere type circuits in a building, you'll notice that the ohms per diameter no longer follows a linear relationship, so that even at 60 hertz, you're starting to get some skin effect in those great big conductors you use for Con Ed and Loco, if you know what I mean. By the time you get up to our frequencies, oh boy, the reason why Lips Wire exists, let me drop. Somebody recognized that the skin effect is a problem. Therefore, you've got two choices. If you're going to make a conductor big enough in diameter that can take a zillion amperes, and you're doing it at an RF frequency, you might as well do it as a piece of copper tubing, because all of the copper in the center is adding weight, adding cost, and not doing anything for you. The signal never gets there because of the skin effect. So the number of ohms per foot goes up real fast as you go up in frequency for any piece of copper conductor. The guys who invented Lips Wire said, let's not use one single wire. Let's use the same effective capture or cross-sectional area of copper, but break it up into 10 or 15 individual wires and insulate them all from each other with copper, with cotton. And Lips Wire is a whole bunch of fine wires, all individually cotton insulated, all wound together. And now each individual wire is doing its skin effect thing, and the total amount of skin is now just going up fantastically for the same amount of copper. You've made a lot more area by a whole bunch of individual wires bundled together as Lips Wire, and therefore you end up with a hell of a lot less loss at the RF frequencies where you use Lips Wire. So this skin effect is always there. One of these days you're going to ask the question, why should there be a skin effect? You're going to have to take my word for it. Again, it's another one of those complicated issues about the method of excitation and re-radiation of the individual molecules on the surface, and the way those molecules communicate with their fellow atoms, I should be saying. Let me drop. The way they communicate with their fellow atoms in that matrix, in that lattice that you and I call a solid piece of copper. It's really a lattice of individual atoms that are locked in place, but they talk to each other. They're all mounted on springs, and they all can wiggle back and forth when a signal is put in there. And they're continuously wiggling back and forth because of the temperature they're at. And because they're wiggling back and forth versus temperature, they are making radio noise. So every resistor you have ever used, you can connect it to an impedance-matched receiver, and you can measure the exact temperature that resistor is at because of the amount of radio noise it issues. A 50-ohm resistor at room temperature connected to a 50-ohm resistor, a 50-ohm receiver, will get an exact amount of noise, minus 114 dBm per megahertz of bandwidth. You double the degrees Kelvin of that resistor, and you will get 3 dB more noise power out of it. The way those molecules are vibrating, even though they're locked into this is a solid material of your resistor, they're locked in place in that matrix, and they're wiggling back and forth in a way that you and I call temperature. That's what your thermometer measures, the average kinetic energy of the translational wiggling of those individual atoms. And that in itself, because there's electrons going around every one of those nucleuses, and every one of those atoms are wiggling back and forth, they are generating a noisy radio signal. And that noise goes from DC to light across the whole darn spectrum. It just barely falls off at very short, high frequencies. And it's a very predictable amount of noise. So the so-called black body radiation. That human being standing in front of a sheetrock wall, you look at him with a radio telescope, and I've done that experiment. I was standing...
Repeater, time out.
I was standing on a wooden chair, adjusting the feed horn in front of my 12-foot dish, just before I listened to the Apollo astronauts. The dish was aimed up into the sky at about a 30-degree angle, sitting on a tripod. I'm standing on a wooden chair, and I'm reaching my hands up to move the position of the feed horn, and the very sensitive receiver that was connected to that feed horn, the noise power went up as I stood on that chair and got in the middle of that dish. The S-band signal coming off my body, because I'm warmer than the cold sky where that dish was aimed. It was going to be aimed at the moon, so to speak. And by looking at the noise coming off that receiver, coming off my body, because my cells were at 98 degrees Fahrenheit when the rest of the sky was a hell of a lot colder. I was radiating a radio signal that almost pegged the needle on that very sensitive receiver I was using. Wonder if I've ever described that experiment to you before, Paul. And you could read about that in, let me think, that was June issue 1972 QST, called Houston, This is Apollo. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Thanks for that explanation, but I thought that the skin effect in conductors was due to free electrons wanting to repel each other, so those free electrons would be sort of on the outside of your conductor, and I thought that effect would be present with DC. Why would that not be the case, DC2IS?
You're now asking for the exact mechanism of the skin effect. Why does the signal only go down a certain distance into the copper as a function of frequency, inverse function of frequency, and as an inverse function of conductivity? Oh, boy. I'm not sure I know the answer to that one, Paul. John. Here we go. Bill. Not sure I know the answer to that one. I know it's true. I've worked with it for 40-some-odd years. I've accepted it. And the exact mechanism of what's happening at the atomic level, I had enough trouble figuring out why water gets hot in a microwave oven. That's a lot more complicated than you would think. It's one of my, that's my puzzle number 33, by the way, which I'll give you someday. Why does water get hot in a microwave oven? I mean, when it comes to conservation of energy, black body, and you're putting a certain number of joules of energy in the water and it gets hot. Oh yeah, that's nice. As a black body, what's really happening? The water molecules decide to move faster in their translational velocity in your microwave oven. What makes them decide to do that? Who gave them the push to make the move instead of 500 meters per second? They decide to move 600 meters per second because they're in your microwave oven. What made them decide to do that? Be amazed what the answer to that is. And it's close to what you're getting at with the skin effect. Ain't easy. And I like giving explanations to people so they can sort of see a mental picture. And I can't easily give you a mental picture on that one right now. And I only partially understand this. I only partially understand any of this jazz you listen to. Wes has got another question. N2XJN, K2IW.
Yeah, and to exceed. Photon energy and photon frequency are nearly the same thing. They're proportional to each other, so actually that's how the wave particle duality works. When you were talking about photon per second, were you talking about 1 hertz?
No, a photon and frequency, yeah, this is the Planck's constant is a relationship between the two.
Proportional to each other.
When you take the photoelectric effect, where a light energy, for instance, strikes the photosensitive material that's in a photomultiplier tube, that's where I think Einstein got his Nobel Prize at first, explaining the photoelectric effect. A certain amount of light energy, a certain number of watts per square centimeter, so to speak, strikes the photosensitive material, and electrons get emitted, and your photomultiplier tube starts multiplying those electrons. Why did that electron on that cathode decide to leave? Because light energy of some number of photons hit it. And the next question is there a limit? I mean, if I made the light energy going into my photodetector weaker and weaker, would all of a sudden the electrons not leave? And the answer is no. They're always leaving. But the rate at which they leave is directly proportional to the amount of photo energy hitting that photocathode. And is there a threshold below which they don't leave? The answer is no. I mean, simplistically, you and I would say, if I go down to one single photon hitting the photodetector, I'm going to get X number of electrons leaving. But if the amount of energy I'm putting in is equivalent to half a photon, am I not going to get any electrons? The answer is I'm still going to get electrons. So is light a particle wave? As you go to weaker and weaker, it doesn't behave like a particle. And maybe it never did. Maybe it's just one philosophy of explanation of the measurements we make. I'm not convinced that light moves in individual bundles called photons. It's a nice philosophy. It's a model. It's a mental model that works most of the time. By the way, all of science, we all want to believe science is a whole bunch of collected, scientifically measured facts. I say it is not. It's a whole bunch of theories and a whole bunch of mental models and diagrams that work most of the time, but none of them work all the time. My best modeling philosophy, my best modeling theory today is going to be partially not so good tomorrow with the later information. It's going to be a more elaborate model. So this photon energy model approach works most of the time. But when I make weaker and weaker signals into any kind of a detector, whether it be a radio detector or a photo detector, you would be led to believe by the photon theory that there's a certain number of joules of energy below which the number of photons is less than unity and I'm not going to get an effect. Not true. There ain't no lower limit. WS2N, K2RIW. That's a bunch of guesses. You got a guess.
Interesting. Well, wave is characterized by the velocity, speed of light, wavelength and frequency. So when considered as particles, they're known as photons. And each has the energy that is related to the frequency of wave given by a Planck constant. So that would be what? E equals HV, where E would be the energy of photon. That would be 6.6 to 6 × 10⁻¹⁴ of J, which that would be the Planck constant. And the V is the frequency of the wave. That's the equation. But I was really puzzled with your sentence saying one photon per second. And when you're talking about one photon per second, well, sadly speak, we should say that photon energy and photon frequency is basically very much similar thing. And because we do have a proportion based on that equation that I told you, then we deal with the wave-particle duality exactly at the same mechanism. So, what was the frequency that you were talking about? Or you were talking about a photon in terms of impulses and exchange?
When the European Southern Observatory made that record-setting measurement of the very weak optical astronomy sensing of Halley's Comet at the distance of the aphelion, its maximum distance from the sun, they really were using the equivalent of a bandpass filter. Their particular optical telescope, I am guessing, had its maximum sensitivity at 550 nanometers. Since it was an optical telescope, I'm guessing it went from roughly 400 to 700 nanometers of wavelength where it was sensitive. So you could call that a bandpass filter. You could say there was a bandpass filter from 400 to 700 nanometers of wavelength. And you can convert that into 10 to the 14 hertz of frequency if you want to. It doesn't matter. Bandpass filter. Once I've got a bandpass filter, and I know within pretty sharp limits exactly what wavelength I'm working with, and when I make the signal weak enough that the signal is for a half a second, a fraction of a photon. And if I'm using the mental model that light comes in these individual bundles at this particular frequency, you and I can use the Planck constant, and we can calculate at that wavelength and that amount of energy, were they exceeding one photon? And the answer might have been no. For half a second, so to speak, it might have been less than one photon. Does that mean that no response of the receiver would take place? Absolutely not. That receiver was giving them a response.
I think I have an answer for it.
Okay, so when I say the photon bundle, corpuscle, whatever you want to call it, philosophy, in this example, that mental model will fail you. There is no limit below which you cannot make a measurement, even though it's a fraction of a photon. You would think that we're talking about a fraction of an electron here, or a fraction of a proton, or a fraction of a photon. At first, in the particle philosophy of life, you would say nothing would happen. They made a measurement over US N2XJN, K2LIW, and the second hand.
Actually, when you were making that sentence, you were supposedly talking about the relationship between the temperature of the body and the emission of the electromagnetic radiation in respect to the inverse square law. So you were talking at that particular frequency of ionizing electromagnetic wave. And that, yes, is being measured in photons, and that is, whenever the photon is available, it comes there. If we talk about ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, that would be...
Okay, I picked up non-ionizing radiation with the usual... Let me drop... The usual definition of ionizing radiation is the X-ray... No, not X-ray. Gamma ray. Here we go. When you go to the soft and hard... What is it now? Is it gamma ray? No. Is it X-ray? What do we call it? Ultraviolet, there we go. Soft, near and far ultraviolet. The threshold between near and far ultraviolet is usually considered the threshold between ionizing and non-ionizing. The optical frequencies your eye operates at, and the optical frequencies that the telescope worked at, are the non-ionizing radiation frequencies. Over to US, K2LAW.
Yes, I agree with you completely, 100%. But that's how the old spectroscopy works. So that point, photon should not be understood in relation to the wavelength or proportionality of the wavelength. But yes, electromagnetic radiation is in the group of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, where the energy, the radio wave is able to remove the electrons and cause the matter to become ionized. And the higher the frequency waves, actually the higher energy it is. So X-ray and gamma rays have ionizing radiation, but also ultraviolet. Those are usually considered to be not ionizing, but they are ionizing frequencies. And to
explain. Yeah, you and I have a little bit of a problem here now, Wes. Let me show you. Ionizing, at that threshold between near and far ultraviolet, and now you go deeper into the far ultraviolet, into X-ray, we call that ionizing radiation. That energy hitting, say for instance, protoplasm, will create ions. In other words, each particle, so to speak, I'm having trouble using the word particle, each particle, each photon, has enough energy that it will cause electrons to leave the individual molecules of your body. It now can disturb individual molecules. It can make ions. It separates the negatively charged electrons from the positively charged nucleuses. It makes ionized material, and that can disturb your DNA. So ultraviolet, near and far ultraviolet can do that. You and I can make a photodetector at infrared frequencies. When I go down to near and far infrared frequencies, I'm way into the region of non-ionizing, where in theory, no electrons are forced, I'm not creating ions. And yet you and I can use a photomultiplier at an infrared frequency. Electrons are boiled off of that cathode of that photomultiplier, and you and I will measure them. So therefore, that energy coming off that photodetector of non-ionizing energy makes the photodetector act as if it had been ionized. Although you've got to carefully choose the materials you put onto that cathode, and you do this in a real high vacuum on that photomultiplier, but still, you choose the right materials, and what you think is non-ionizing energy gives an ionizing effect. Ain't that crazy? And 2XJN, K2LIW.
Yes, actually, all objects above the temperature of absolute zero, which would be what, -273.15 Celsius, radiate the energy, and that would be the particles radiation, but the electromagnetic waves emit discrete units, and those would be the photons that travel at the speed of light as a form of electromagnetic waves. And then we see the Kelvin dependency to the electromagnetic waves, which